The Broadway Hour. This is Stuart Klein, your host for the Broadway Hour. Stay tuned for what I think will be an invigorating hour all about the theater. You're on AM 93 WPAT every Monday night from 6 to 7. Brought to you by Sheraton New York Hotel and Towers and Kennicle Bank. Good evening and welcome to the Broadway Hour. I'm Stuart Klein, your host for the next 60 minutes of Broadway news, Broadway interviews, Broadway songs, and Broadway gossip, and much ado about Off-Broadway, too. We're coming to you from the Sheraton New York Hotel and Towers at 53rd Street, overlooking placid 7th Avenue, where we have our live taping in the Lobby Court Lounge. I'm looking out the window now, and it is indeed placid. You're invited to join us every Thursday afternoon for the taping between 4:30 and 6. We have a rather distinguished audience tonight, and we have some very distinguished guests. This is the Broadway Hour. I'm Stuart Klein, and let's kick off the show up-tempo with some world-class jazz musicians performing live. On guitar, Joe Puma, on bass, Murray Wall, and on cornet, returning to the Broadway Hour, Warren Vache. Ladies and gentlemen, the Warren Vache Trio.
Thank you.
Warren Vache Trio and I Want to Be Happy from No No Nanette. Warren, it's great to have you back. And it was also great to see you in that sensational sextet backing up Rosie Clooney at Rainbow and Stars. You just don't see a sextet in New York clubs anymore.
Not these days. It's very, very rare. It's true.
What happened, Warren? What has happened to jazz in New York?
Well, all the little clubs that I used to know and work in are all closed now. I don't know whether it was real estate prices or what, Stuart, but it's sure hard to find a good jazz band in New York these days.
I came to New York in 1960, and you could go from one end of Manhattan to another and find a jazz spot every 3 minutes, up and down, from the kitchen up at Columbia at 115th and Broadway, downtown to the Village. Jimmy Ryan's, Eddie Condon's, they're all gone.
Yeah, one of the interesting things, too, I mean, I really learned to play in those places, and I wonder where kids today go to learn to play, you know?
As a consequence, Warren, you're on the road an awful lot, right?
I'm about 7 months a year on the road, yes.
7 months?
Yeah.
And you do an awful lot of work in Europe and Japan.
Europe and Japan is basically where my business is now, yeah.
Where I think jazz musicians are treated much more kindly than they are here in New York.
They certainly hire us much more often than they do around here.
Well, Warren, give us another taste. You just did I Want to Be Happy. You got some more happy music?
We got another happy song for you. This is Get Happy.
Go.
Maybe it'll work.
Thank you.
All right, the Warren Vache Trio. Joe Pumo on guitar, Mary Wall on bass, and Warren Vache on cornet. The Warren Vache Trio will be at Sam's in Creskill, New Jersey, March the 2nd, and we might have another taste of them later on the Broadway Hour. Right now, let's go to this break, after which Frank Rich, Brian Mitchell, and our trivia contest, still to come. This is the Broadway Hour on AM 93 WPAT. I'm Stuart Klein, and our next guest is returning to the Broadway Hour, this time as one of the stars of the musical Kiss of the Spider Woman. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Brian Mitchell. Brian, welcome back.
Thank you, Stuart. It's nice to be here.
The last time you were here, you were just in the process of replacing Gregory Hines in Jelly's Last Jam.
Right.
And now you're moving into the lead role of Valentine in Kiss of the Spider Woman. How'd that happen?
Well, I think it was just one of those things where Anthony Crivella was ready to leave, and I was available because Jelly had left the theater at that time, so I had about a month in between there, and they asked me to come in and take over for him.
You're doing pretty good for a guy without a steady job.
That's right, without a real job.
How did you get the part in the Spider-Woman?
Basically auditioning, and people had seen my work from before. That's the nice thing about New York and the Broadway whole circle, is that it's a very closed group and people are familiar with what everybody else is doing. Whereas in Los Angeles, where I also do a lot of work, nobody really knows what anyone else is up to, it seems like. So that's the nice thing. When I come to town here, people are aware of what the other actors are doing in some of the other shows. And
speaking of Los Angeles and people not knowing some of the work you do, I suspect there's not a soul in this vast posh lobby that knows that you are the voice of one of the California Raisins.
That's right.
Give us a sample of that, Brian.
Well, I played a raisin named Red, and he was a really cool raisin. He's the one with the sunglasses.
I heard it through the grapevine. You started to tell me that you auditioned for Spider-Woman. What did you do at your audition, Brett?
I just basically did the two songs from the show. One of the songs is Martz and the other one is Day After That, which are the two big songs that the character Valentine sings in the show. And they're also happen to be the highest songs that he sings. So I went in and auditioned for Hal Prince about 2 weeks before I left for Los Angeles. But he didn't have me read at the time. And I was thinking I should have read for him because I knew I was going to be leaving and I knew that he wouldn't be able to see me then. And as it turned out, I guess a few weeks later, they said that they wanted me to do it, even without me reading. So
this was a one shot, no callback or anything? They just heard you sing one?
It was really nice. It was really nice.
Brian, in Jelly, when you played Jelly Roll Morton in Jelly's Last Jam, you are a roué, a womanizing jazz man who traveled the country winning and abandoning beautiful women here and there.
Yeah, it's just typecasting, I guess.
to go to the other extreme, Spider-Woman is essentially a love story about two guys in a prison cell.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about doing love scenes with a guy?
Well, it kind of evens it out now. I've had the yin and the yang of it, I guess, between Jelly and this. Uh-huh. You know, it's a whole different kind of thing, but it's done really tastefully in the show too. People aren't sure how it's done, and I think what's the nice part of it? It's a lot of it's left up to the audience's imagination, really. Not too much, but some.
Okay, I'm listening to this tasteful exercise in love scenes between two guys.
Yeah.
No qualms about that.
No, you know, it's part of the work that I do. I mean, that's one of the interesting things I think about being an actor is you get to kind of explore different people and different lifestyles and different, you get to step into somebody else's shoes constantly. And it's really an interesting thing to see how other people live and to feel how other people live and feel what people go through. I would never have the experience of what it's like to be in an Argentine prison. And doing the research for this, I really get a flavor of what that's like. And to be stuck in a cell with one person for basically the rest of your life.
How's the show holding up? You know, a show about the ravages of a South American dictatorship especially the pain of which is felt by two gay guys in a prison cell, is not what you would call the story of your average Broadway musical.
Actually, the character that I play, Valentine, is not gay. The other character is a gay window dresser. Okay. And that's the whole conflict between the two characters. Right. Mine is a very macho revolutionary character, and his is this very flamboyant homosexual.
Right.
And that's the whole conflict in the show, is their relationship, basically.
Well, as I said in my original question, is this playing to assorted audiences? Are Hadassah parties coming to see Spider-Woman?
Yeah, all kinds of, we have all kinds of audiences there. I think what people relate to in the show is the fact that it's still very much universal themes. It's about love, it's about tenderness, it's about compassion, it's about bravery. It's about a lot of universal themes that everybody can relate to, and it's written wonderfully and directed wonderfully, so that the points just get across so beautifully. I think everybody can really relate to them and get something out of it. I think a lot of audiences are surprised at how much there is for them in the show.
Now, working in Spider-Woman, you're working with two legends. You're in the show now with Cheetah Rivera in the title role.
I just love her.
How are you getting along with Cheetah?
Oh, great. She is one of the great people of the world. I'm having so much fun with her.
She give you any tips about your role, about performing?
It's funny because Cheetah and I actually work so little together on the stage. I think I say all of three lines because she's kind of the fantasy character of the Melina character. And the one line I say to her is I kind of jump into a fantasy for a second, and then she sings a song to me while I'm unconscious on stage. So I always say to Cheetah, well, Cheetah, it's been great not working with you today.
And coming into the show next week, subbing as Cheetah takes a short vacation, is the immortal Carol Lawrence, who was the original Maria in West Side Story.
She's another wonderful performer, too.
Have you met Carol?
Yes, we met actually during Jelly. That's the first time that we met. She came backstage then and introduced herself to me. And then when I went into the show here, she had gone in for a few weeks in Spider-Woman. So I went in and saw one of the performances that she did. So it was like a reunion when we got together.
Brian, what's it like stepping into a role that you have not created? Does that bring any additional pressure or any additional problems to your normal Broadway playing?
Yes and no. Jelly was tougher because of Gregory and the tap dancing. And he so defines tap dancing in the United States, really, in the
He's
world.
He's exactly. It. In my humble opinion, forgive me for interrupting, in my humble opinion, the greatest song and dance man now performing on stage is Gregory Hines. I don't think it's close. People they know what a great dancer he is, but he is also a sensational singer.
Yes, absolutely. I really agree with you there. That's what makes it tough, though, to follow somebody like that. What I try to do is find things in the role that would that are my strengths, and discover other parts about the character. It's the same thing with Valentine. I'm trying to find other areas that haven't quite been explored. And because I'm a different person totally, of course, I'm going to be have a whole different take on the character. So that's what makes it interesting, actually. I can't say that I'm intimidated by it. I think it's more of a challenge for me as an actor.
Mm-hmm. I hesitate to ask, but where do you go from here, Brian?
I don't know. I'm looking forward to doing another original show next. That's what I would like to go into and create something again.
Robert Guillaume is going into Cyrano shortly. Should we suggest that he watch himself in case there's someone coming in soon? What would you like to do, Brian?
You know, actually, I'm a composer, and I've been writing for quite a long time. And when I was doing Trapper John, I ended up scoring a lot of those shows, and I did I've written a lot of symphonic works and everything. And in the last 4 or 5 years, I've really concentrated on writing for musical theater. And it's something that I had done for quite a few years because I was working with a repertory company where I was the resident composer. And now it's just time. I have some ideas now that I've started fleshing out, and I think it's time for me to tackle that.
Want to give us a quick clue about what this might be?
No, because it's still in its infant stages, so it might not be recognizable by the time it comes out.
Another guarded artist.
Yes.
Well, Brian, I want to wish you all the best of luck in whatever you do. Any last words about your present endeavor?
Just come see the show. It's a terrific show. I think everybody would enjoy it.
Ladies and gentlemen, the temporary Brian Mitchell, now starring in Kiss of the Spider-Man. Thank you, Brian.
Thanks.
Delightful having you back.
Thank you.
We have a chef here in a long white hat. Come on over, Chef. What do you got? This is Chef Baz from Bistro 790, and you have a plate of what looks like scallops, I think.
Yes, pan-seared sea scallops.
Okay.
Baby greens and a red pepper vinaigrette.
Sea scallops with baby greens in a red pepper vinaigrette. You don't know how I've been longing for this, Chef Baz. And thank you very much. It smells great. And if I'm not mistaken, executive producer Kate McGrath is now going to scarf this up rapidly. Let's go, ladies and gentlemen, to the Broadway update brought to you by Taittinger Champagne, the official champagne of the Broadway Hour. How much does the Broadway Theater contribute to New York City's economy? In cold cash, $2.3 billion a year. Billion. So says a Port Authority study surveying the 1992 season. The study says some 2.5 million out-of-towners came to Broadway to see a show, and they spent more than $266 million on restaurants, $242 million on hotels, and $35 million on taxicabs. $2.3 billion a year, and many news directors in New York still refuse to run reviews of Broadway shows because they say nobody cares. Forgive the editorial comment. A revival of the Frank Lesser musical, How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying, directed by Tommy's Des McAnuff and starring Matthew Broderick in the Bobby Morse role, will open in October at the La Jolla Playhouse in California. That's a production I'd like to see on Broadway. An unpromising road note, in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, a production of Death of a Salesman, starring Judd Hirsch and Eva Marie Saint, was panned soundly by Variety. The notice said the two stars were too elegant and lacked the necessary passion of the devastated Brooklyn salesman and his wife. A couple of Broadway cast changes. Robert Guillaume on March 8th replaces Bill Van Dyke in the title role of Cyrano the Musical. And on March 15th, Karen Ziemba succeeds Jody Benson in the sparkling Gershwin musical Crazy for You. Eli Wallach and Ann Jackson will lend some much-needed support to the National Actors Theater when they star in the company's third production of the season, The Flowering Peach by Clifford Odets. Performances start March 8th. The scheduled London opening of Maxwell the Musical, a show about the shyster media mogul who went overboard for good, was halted by a judge's injunction on the dubious reasoning that the musical might prejudice an upcoming fraud trial of Maxwell's two sons. Items like this one make one appreciate once more that glorious First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, there shall be no abridgment of the freedom of speech. Some off-Broadway notes. Avenue X, a new musical about interracial tensions in Brooklyn in 1963, opens tonight at the Wilder Theater on 42nd Street. It's a production of the Playwrights Horizon Company. The America Play by Susan Laurie Parks starts performances tonight at Joe Papp's Public Theater. It's billed as an absurdist vaudeville centering on a black actor said to bear an uncanny resemblance to Abraham Lincoln, who creates a traveling show. Opening Sunday at the Orpheum is Stomp, starring an 8-member British percussion group who play music with broomsticks, tin cans, Zippo lighters, and other gear that includes everything except conventional musical instruments. Now at the Village Theater Company on West 22nd Street is Blue Skies Forever by Clear Braz Valentine, a new play exploring the mystery of Amelia Earhart. And speaking of mysteries, pick up a new book called Lindbergh the Crime by Noel Ben. It's absolutely fascinating, alleging that the Lindbergh baby was killed not by Bruno Richard Hauptmann, but by a member of the Lindbergh family, and that the entire story of the baby's kidnapping was a hoax designed to cover up the killing. I couldn't put the book down. We'll be back with Frank Rich, more music from Warren Vacher and friends, and our trivia contest after this. And it's trivia time. And the winner of this week's contest will win two tickets to Rosemary Clooney's show at Rainbow and Stars and dinner for two at Streeter's Cafe here at the Sheraton. Here's the question. Mayor Jimmy Walker was portrayed in a Broadway musical, and the mayor in that show even sang a song. What was the show, and what was the song? And Susie Shulman is raising her arm wildly, she knows. If you think you know and want to take a shot at the freebie theater tickets and dinners, last week's question was, listen in carefully, one of the all-time stars of Hollywood horror movies appeared on stage in a Broadway musical, and to the surprise of many, he sang very well. Who was this horror villain, and what was the show? Frank Rich, you know the answer? Susie Shulman? Well, Warren Wise of New York City knew that the answer is Boris Karloff, who starred on Broadway in Peter Pan. Congratulations, Warren. You win two tickets to the new Edward Albee play, Three Tall Women, and dinner for two at Bistro's 790 here at the Sheraton. And now, ladies and gentlemen, from the 1950 Broadway production of Peter Pan, here's Boris Karloff singing Plank.
There was a man and his name was Frank. Hey ho for the old man Frank, but he had bad habits, cursed and drank. We had to make him walk the plank, 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 plank.
There
plank,
was a man
plank,
and his plank, name was Frank.
There hey, was a man and his name was Frank,
but he had bad habits, cursed and drank. We had to make his walk the plank.
Yeah, you have the model. Planks are useful toys. Your bad habits solve your problems, especially for little boys.
Boris Karloff in a short song from the 1950 production of Peter Pan. Our next guest is the New York Times columnist who, before going legit, was the chief drama critic of the Times, a post he held for 13 years. Ladies and gentlemen, long one of the most influential and incisive voices on the American theater, my old friend and colleague, Frank Rich.
Great to see you.
Frank, welcome to the Broadway Hour.
Thanks for having me.
It's my treat. Let me begin by asking you this, Frank. You are now in a position where you do not have to see Tony Randall playing a 23-year-old in The Government Inspector.
I miss that? Oh, my God.
No regrets about missing that.
No, I'm a little bit more choosy about what I see. Of course, I haven't been out of the critic's job that long.
Right.
So there haven't been that many openings since I left. And, you know, I'm still going, but I'm waiting for the reviews a little bit more.
How are you thriving in your new life as a columnist?
I'm enjoying it. It's a totally different schedule. It's a lot of work. I'm still, you know, changing my biological clock or whatever it is. But it's fun. It's sort of being let out of the box to be able to write about anything. Although, of course, in your job, you could, certainly within the world of culture and entertainment, had a lot more freedom than just a regular drama critic would have.
I must say that I suppose in my job I have more freedom than anyone in television. When I'm on. Don't get on that much anymore. So you do not miss the daily grind of
No, I mean, I'm still in the daily grind. It's just a different kind of grind. And daily and Sunday.
Frank, tell me about moving. Were you anxious to leave the drama critic's post?
Yeah, you know, what really happened was a couple of years ago, I had some things happen in my personal life. It was a tragedy in my family. I also got married again. My view just began to shift. I also got very caught up in politics. I'd always been interested in politics, but during the 92 campaign, I actually worked at covering the campaign a bit.
You did some wonderful pieces with Maureen Dowd.
With Maureen Dowd, who invited me to do them.
Too.
We did a column at both conventions, thanks, and at the inaugural. And I'm a couple of years younger than Bill Clinton. I may not be like him in any other way, except I'm vaguely from the South. But somehow my generation coming to center stage, if you will, in American life turned me on. And I realized there were a lot of other things I wanted to write about, and I just wasn't as satisfied just writing about the theater. I loved writing about the theater still, but I wanted to do other things. And so I started talking with the Times almost 2 years before I actually left the job about what I might do next, and ultimately they came up with this incredible opportunity for me.
Did the fact that you had been under, I think, so much pressure with all of this business for years, with producers calling you the butcher on Broadway and all that malarkey, did that play any part in your decision to change jobs?
I can't say it played a major role. It certainly played an incidental role, in the sense that, not that, you know, I knew before I got into the job that New York Times drama critic is always going to be vilified by people in the theater, and it was true of Atkinson and Walter Kerr. Why shouldn't it be true of me? But it seemed to me that as theater production dropped, I mean, the number of Broadway plays dropped by almost 50% during the time I was in the job, roughly 60 a season to 30 a season. It seemed to me to be almost the principal industry of the theater seemed to be gossip, whether about me or anyone else. Mm. And it seemed to me a kind of aging business. And in that sense, all the backbiting dramatized my major feeling, which was not so much to escape that, but to there were other things I wanted to do that had, that to me were more important to write about.
I have said many times on the air that the beating you took on this Butcher of Broadway business was so mistaken and so misguided, because it is not critics who close shows, as we know. I have said over and over and over again, and I defy anyone to dispute this, that if a show is good, it's going to run. And if a show is not good, it usually will not run, regardless of what any critics say.
It's true. The audience, particularly at these ticket prices, the audience decides very quickly what it wants or not. It's a very severe market economy, let's face it. And if people feel they're getting their money's worth from Phantom of the Opera, they're going to flock to it, whether I like it or not. I didn't like it very much. Who remembers or cares? At the same time, at these prices, if it's a nice little well-meaning play that's not exciting, you and I can praise it to the skies, and it's not going to make any difference. And even, you know, look at a play like Grapes of Wrath, which wasn't even little,
right,
which got great reviews and won the Tony Award, including a great review from me. It flopped on Broadway. And so there's a real economic problem in the theater that is making it a survival of the fittest that really eliminates the critic's role to an extent.
Frank, in your wonderful piece that you did for the Sunday Times Magazine, talking, reminiscing about your life as a critic over the last 13 years, you had a delicious anecdote about what the life of a critic is that I thought was encapsulated perfectly. Following your auto accident, and you were receiving treatment from a doctor.
Oh, right. This is very early when I was in the job. It's my first summer on the job, 1980. I went to cover a play in Williamstown, Massachusetts, and coming back, I was in a really awful car accident. One thing I had in the piece, but I had to cut out for space, I was with a friend named Rafael Iglesias, who's a novelist, who this year wrote the novel and the movie Fearless about the survivors of a plane
right.
crash. The inspiration for writing that book was from this car crash. He had never been in a plane crash, but we were in this car crash together. He survived incredibly without injuries. The car was destroyed. I fractured my collarbone. I'm taken by ambulance from Otis, Massachusetts, down to New York. I'm put on a table by an orthopedist who's really giving me a lot of pain, manipulating my collarbone. And he says to me, may I ask you, I have to tell you something. May I ask you something? And I, oh, my God, he's going to tell me I have a week to live. And he said, can you get me 2 tickets for Barnum Saturday night? didn't that happen to you all the time?
I mean, that is the last. Well, I remember I once get a call on a Wednesday afternoon. This is 10, 15 years ago, from my cousin Annette in Philadelphia.
That you'd never heard of before.
Yes,
right?
Yeah. Who I see about once a decade. She and her husband, Irving, are celebrating their whatever wedding anniversary that weekend.
It's always Irving, isn't it?
Yes. And can I get her 6 tickets to a Chorus Line for Saturday night? Mm. Now, this is when a Chorus Line was the hot ticket in New York. She wanted 6. This is Wednesday. She went on 6 on Saturday. Well, I start making a lot of promises and favors and all, and I round up the 6 tickets.
That's amazing.
Great pain. And Annette calls me on Friday, and she says, Stuart, me and Irving can't come. Forget it.
I've had exactly the same thing, and I've had it happen with real relatives as opposed to distant relatives who have me line up a week of Christmas Eve going, oh, well, the weather's kind of lousy. We'll stay at home. Thanks, and you can cancel all the tickets, can't you?
I said to Annette, don't ever call me again about theater tickets, and don't ever call me again about anything.
And did she obey?
Yes. So far, I haven't heard from Annette. Listen, 1980 was... the time when you had your first, quote, big night as a critic, that was the opening of the memorable opening of 42nd Street. Remember that night, Frank?
Oh, I sure do. I mean, that was an amazing night because, as you know, it was a rare example of critics actually covering a show on opening night for the simple reason that David Merrick, a brilliant promoter of his wares, had shut down all the previews of the show at the Winter Garden to... create an air, an air of mystery and suspense. And so I was a nervous wreck. I was filling in for Walter Kerr, who was still the Daily Critic at that time. I had just been hired by the Times. I had my arm in a sling. I had just had that accident. And I go to that show, and I didn't love it. I didn't hate it. I thought it was sort of mixed. And as I'm leaving the theater, but before the curtain calls in, someone, practically a stranger, stops me and says, Frank, did you hear Gower Champion died? And I went, what? I couldn't believe that I thought it was maybe a hoax. And I didn't know what to do because I had to go back to the paper and deal with a lonely night copy editor. I was not a reporter. I had no way of verifying this. I thought, have I been handed the scoop of the century or am I being set up by Mr. Merrick? And
Gower Champion, of course, was the director.
The director of 42nd Street, legendary figure in the theater. And as I finally arrived at the Times to start writing my review, I remember it was when phones still had rings before the electronic phone. I walked into the empty news floor, the third floor of the Times building, and every phone in the so-called culture department was ringing because all the Times reporters and editors who had stayed to the end of the curtain calls had heard Merrick announce from the stage that Gower Champion had indeed died. In fact, he had died hours earlier, and Merrick had kept it secret to hype the show. And indeed, he was a genius. It wasn't a great show, but it was on the front page of every newspaper in the world. It didn't make a difference what the critics said. It was a hit for years, obviously.
What a night to break in. I remember I got up as the curtain came down and started to run up the aisle to run back and do my piece. And Fred Nathan, the press agent for the show, grabbed me. He figuratively, literally grabbed me. And he said, Stu, Gower Champion is dead, and Merrick is going to come on stage and announce it. Don't go.
See, you were television. I was print. They didn't give a damn about me.
So I went back. I heard that thing. My God, what a night. I remember leaving the theater. I ran to a phone after Merrick made his announcement and called the desk and told them that Champion was dead. And they said, my God, that'll be the lead story in news. Can you get back in time? I said, sure. Well, this is about 20 after 9. And I take a cab and go back, and I start banging on a typewriter. They had somebody at the office had called the hospital and got a little bit, some esoteric disease that he had died of. And then I went on with the lead story, finished, came back. Wrote my review, went back on the review. What a night.
Incredible.
Listen, we got to take a break, and we'll be back with Frank Rich right after this. This is the Broadway Hour on AM 93 WPAT. I'm Stuart Klein, and with me is Frank Rich, the longtime drama critic of the New York Times, and now its distinguished op-ed page columnist. Frank, in 13 years, what was the worst play you ever reviewed?
What do you think?
I would guess it's M.M.
Right, Moose Murders. You reviewed it. I recall watching your review. It actually did get one favorable review from a television critic, but we'll be nice and not say who founded this wacky new comedy.
Remind our audience what Moose Murders was
about. Moose Murders was a play about, it was a murder mystery on Broadway set at an Adirondack's hunting lodge full of antlers, where, that's sort of a Stu Klein line, whereas I recall the murderer turned out to be a quadriplegic who, for the entire play, was in a wheelchair and wrapped in gauze, and then abruptly stood up in the last few minutes of the play and tried to murder someone with a moose head on his head. And it was infamous even before it opened, because it was supposed to be Eve Arden's triumphant return to legitimate theater.
She's in it.
She dropped out after two previews, and actually a very, very good actress named Holland Taylor, who's gone on to much better things,
right,
had to preside over this fiasco.
There was a young actress in the play whose name escapes me, but she wrote a piece later for Esquire magazine.
Hilarious piece. It was June Gable.
June Gable, that's right.
And she described the sensation that I also had when seeing it, which is that the critic's performance, how do we say this delicately in the air, someone had indisposed himself in the front rows of the orchestra, creating an odor that drove away half the audience that remained as it was. Also, I believe there was a very obnoxious little child actress,
yes,
who,
yes,
kept tap dancing through that,
yes,
show, who I think later or earlier played Joan Crawford's daughter in Mommy Dearest. Played Faye Dunaway's daughter in Mommy Dearest.
When June Gable wrote that piece for Esquire, near the top of the piece, she quoted me saying,
right,
that it was so bad that you had to laugh to keep from crying. So I later framed the piece, the Esquire piece, and I hung it in my bathroom, and my wife made me take it down. She said, I will not have that in my house.
Oh, really? Because I have to say, I have the Moose Murders window card in my kids' room.
I would say a close second, tell me if you agree with this, as the worst in 13 years, was a rock musical called Marlowe. Do you remember that?
Marlowe, the opening song, he was a 16th century man with a 20th century mind.
I remember a better lyric from the opening song.
Yes.
When the cast came out in hot pants, short hot pants, and there was a heavy rock beat to which they sang, they didn't have toilets in 1593. Hey, nonny, nonny, life back then was not very funny.
Oh, it's time for a revival of those shows. I think it should be done in rep.
Frank, we're talking about bombs, but some of the great nights in the theater. Well, what were some of your great ones?
There's no way I could come up with a complete list. There were so many more good,
yes,
things than bad things. But you know, I remember Sunday in the Park with George, Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, Amadeus with Ian McKellen. And
well, you wrote one piece that I will never forget. I think it's the best review I ever read in my life. And that was the piece you wrote on the anniversary performance, the record-breaking performance of A Chorus Line, when all 500 dancers from the show came back. That night lives in memory forever.
That was an incredible night, a sort of outpouring of love in the theater between artists and audience and people backstage and on stage. And, of course, it later became even sort of a tragic end, because no one knew at the time Michael Bennett was probably already ill and would die a few years later.
And I remember that you captured so well in your piece the theme of that show, which was all these dancers dancing for the love of dancing in a Broadway show, and by and large dancing in a chorus and never achieving fame. And I remember you pointed out there, here were all of these dancers who had performed in the show coming back to take part in this record-setting performance, with literally hundreds of dancers descending from the balcony and from the wings and up the aisles. And none of them were recognizable. None of them had achieved fame, which was the very essence of a chorus line.
It's true. I mean, it really was a case of life imitating art. And I think one reason why it's obvious why that show has so much resonance to people who work in the theater, because there are many wonderful, brilliantly talented people in the theater who never do achieve fame. And it doesn't mean that their careers are any less worthy than, say, stars or star playwrights, directors. But I think also this was the appeal of Chorus Line to a mass audience beyond the theater, people who never worked in the theater, because it's true of, you know, of the country we live in. I think that they hit on something there. Most people, work hard at something they love, and they do it for love. As hackneyed as that lyric now seems after we heard it in a million lounges like this through the years, but it's true. And the only reward is the act of doing it itself. It's not riches or
a chorus line. Of course, Frank, was produced by Joe Papp, the late Joe Papp. How did you get along with him over the years?
I had good periods and bad periods with Joe Papp. I was not an intimate of his. My relationship was mainly in theater lobbies. Essentially, he took the same attitude as most theater people. If I'd written a good review, he thought I was fantastic. And if I didn't like something he did, he thought I was the devil or the butcher or whatever. And what I admired about Papp, though, was that although he could be angry and furious at me or other people, he really fought for his shows, good, bad, or indifferent. Plus, he had a vision of a nonprofit theater-producing organization that really revolutionized the American theater throughout the 1960s, 70s, and the 80s.
The night that A Chorus Line closed, after the closing night performance, there was a big dinner, Mamma Leone's.
Right.
And that night, I did something that I never thought I would do in a million years. I went up to Joe, and I said, Joe, would you sign my program of A Chorus Line? And he wrote this funny bit on the program. He wrote, "To my friend Stuart, over the years, you have broken my hump many times, and I'm cleaning this up a lot. But with affection and esteem, yours, Joe Papp."
Oh, yeah. I occasionally get nice words from him, and then he'd be angry at me, too, and that's to be expected.
Frank, how has the theater changed in the 13 years that have passed since you began?
Well, I'd say there are two main changes. One has to do with the art and one with the business. In terms of the art of the theater, the biggest change has been, I think, an explosion of a very diverse playwriting talent. When I first started, a Broadway play could still be something like mixed doubles, you know, of kind of impersonal entertainment that might be done better by television. There was still a place for that on Broadway. That's pretty much gone now.
Right.
And in its place, you have writers like Tony Kushner of Angels in America or August Wilson, writers who represent David Henry Hwang, who wrote M. Butterfly, the kind of writers who represent either ethnic groups or sexual groups or whatever, who weren't regularly heard from in an open way in the front of the American theater as opposed to the basements and attics of the American theater. I think that the theater much more now reflects society. I think, however, the Broadway's economic system has continued to rot during this time.
So while we are getting some new plays that we haven't gotten before, we aren't getting many of them.
No, we're getting them off Broadway, and sometimes they transfer to Broadway. But basically, if you want to see the most important plays in New York now, you're going to go to the Manhattan Theater Club or Lincoln Center or Playwrights Horizons. And occasionally, sure, a Wendy Wasserstein play will move to a Broadway house, but that's the exception rather than the rule, and you should go get while the getting's good at a lower price. What Broadway, the commercial theater, has not figured out is how to get these good new plays to the audience at an affordable cost. It's a distribution problem almost, as you'd say in the movie industry. The talent is there, But it's an older generation of Broadway producers just hasn't given any thought to the problems. There's a lot of blustering. You know, someone like Emanuel Eisenberg, who produces Neil Simon, every year he announces that he's going to, you know, reform Broadway.
Do a $15 show with no costumes or scenery, but it never happens.
It never happened. He announced a big plan with some other producers at the Barrymore Theater to do classics. Mm-hmm. Made the front page of the Times, I think. Never happens. There's a lot of big bluster, but it's really the Andre Bishops, the Lynn Meadows, the successors to Joe Papp that are trying to solve these problems, but they need some help from the elderly people who are running Broadway to try to bring their plans to fruition.
We only have 2 minutes left. I'm angry. Frank, you got to come back. We got to do some more.
I'd love to, Stu. I mean, one of the things I miss most about covering theater as a beat, as opposed, I still go as a civilian, is seeing you. We had some real laughs,
We had fun. When I first began on Broadway, it was considered absolutely finpuds. You just could not talk about a play at intermission, you know, on the night you were seeing it. But sometimes you sat through these things and you couldn't help.
Well, sometimes you felt, you know, if you're on the Titanic, you might as well sit in the same lifeboat.
Ladies and gentlemen, Frank Rich is coming back. You promised to come back on the Broadway?
I absolutely do, Stu, anytime.
Frank Rich, ladies and gentlemen, of the New York Times.
Thanks for having me.
And let's get off with some music by the Warren Vacher Trio. Warren, play us off. Ladies and gentlemen, you've been listening to the Broadway Hour. Thanks to our guests, Frank Rich, Brian Mitchell, and the Warren Vacher Trio. The Broadway Hour is here on 93 WPAT every Monday night from 6 to 7. I'd like to thank the sponsors of the Broadway Hour, Chemical Bank, the Sheraton New York Hotel and Towers, and Champagne Taittinger, the official champagne of the Broadway Hour. Thanks to our executive producer, Kate McGrath, and our engineer, Chris Breedfelt, and special thanks to all the folks at WPA2. Tune in next week when our guests will include composer Maury Esten and actor Josh Mostel. This is Stuart Klein for the Broadway Hour. Good night and break a leg.